I think Claude Anthropic is going to be just fine. And any tool that you think you're going to use for something good, someone else is going to use it for something bad.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where our expert panelists turn the biggest industry news stories into practical takeaways you can use. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and today we almost have a Not the Situation Room crossover, because we've got both Nick Bradley, Manager, X-Force Threat Intelligence, and Dave Bales, North American Lead Managing Consultant, X-Force Cyber Range, and joining us, J.R. Rao, IBM Fellow and CTO Security Research. Thank you, folks, for being here. Here's what's on the agenda. The ongoing Team PCP breach spree, the case for sharing our close calls with cyber threats, and what, if anything, legitimate businesses can learn from cyber criminals when it comes to AI adoption. But first, folks, you knew we had to talk about the Claude Code source code leak. Now, I'm sure everybody's heard about this already. Claude Code's source code leaked last week briefly on NPM when Anthropic accidentally published a version of the tool that contained a file with all its source code. Attackers are already taking advantage of the mishap to spread malware, notably the Vidar info stealer, by posting fake repos on GitHub claiming to be forks of this source code. But I'm wondering if we need to think about more sophisticated threats that might come down the pipeline, because this means the source code has fallen into many people's hands who really probably shouldn't have it. And JR, I want to start by asking you what you think the kind of potential security ramifications are here for organizations, not even necessarily Anthropic, but the rest of us who now live in a world where attackers have their hands on Claude Code source code. What's your take here?
My point of view is that this is not really a leak problem, and neither is it a Claude problem. This is really a AI era supply chain security problem. And it is a problem with NPM. What we've seen for many, many years now is that the NPM seems to have a soft underbelly where it has been subject to many attacks, like typo squatting attacks, dependency confusion attacks, and so on. And so what we are actually what we are finding here is that attackers are actually exploiting the supply chain. And then the blame, of course, goes to the end users, which is Claude in this case. And that is where the Claude code leak is all about. Now, what defenders should do is try to remember that this is no longer, we are moving from an era where we had vulnerabilities to where trust chains are being subverted. And the trust chain in this case is the trust chain that goes through NPM. So one has to be very cognizant of one's supply chain and the trust chain that comes along with the supply chain. So look specifically at things like lookalike packages that may be targeting some of your workflows. Look at some exploits that may be aimed at agentic systems. And this we're going to see more of because agents are not going to be as adept at finding some of these typo squatting kind of attacks that humans might be in using tools or accessing files or executing shells. And be aware of how API keys or embedded logic patterns can get abused as we go forward. So that is my take on this, Matt.
Absolutely. And I like that you point out that it's kind of a double whammy almost, right? Because it's not just a compromise of a specific kind of agent and its code, but it's also a compromise of that larger supply chain system. So like now it's in and it's connected to a lot of things potentially, and attackers can really move around there. And that brings me to my next question, which I want to pose to you here, Dave, because obviously, look, nobody likes a source code leak, but is there something special about when the source code comes from an AI tool, specifically an AI coding tool that's integrated in all kinds of sensitive, you know, CI/CD pipelines and such? Is this worse than your average kind of source code leak? Are the ramifications potentially bigger? What's your take here, Dave?
I think the ramifications are potentially bigger. It allows them to take the guardrails off of the AI that are in place to prevent them from doing the very thing that they will eventually do, and that's to use this source code to create their own little repository of bad actor things. And that, I mean, that's a really simplistic way of looking at it. But as we learned a week or two ago, even going on to NPM and looking at the hash and making sure this is the right hash doesn't work because there are ways to subvert the hash planting there as well. So there are so many bad things that can come from this, the least of which is hackers just playing around with it. They're going to use this. They're going to weaponize this, and it's going to be bad. But let's hope that Anthropic comes through with a fix for it that kind of renders this source code unusable.
And Nick, I want to bring you in here too, you know, not to keep prognosticating on what terrible things can happen, but I do want to get your take in terms of what's the potential fallout for this, for you know, this source code falling into the wrong hands. What do you think we're looking at?
First off, I think Claude Anthropic is going to be just fine. I think there'll be a little blip for a little while, maybe a black eye, but I think they're going to be just fine. And this feels like what's old is new again, because really what it's going to be is the same as back in the day when you wanted to go out and get a copy of something you couldn't afford. You went to a pirate site, downloaded a cracked copy or whatnot. And that's the greatest threat right now that I perceive. I mean, that's short term, because you're going to see people going out and thinking, hey, I'm going to go get me a copy. And they're going to download something that's Trojanized, some malware, something like that. And that's going to be the initial threat. The long-term threat, as my colleagues have mentioned, is the use of it for malicious things. And that's, again, obvious. But I still want to say we should have seen that coming. We can't have nice things. Everything nice we have has to be abused. And any tool that you think you're going to use for something good, someone else is going to use it for something bad. And as a threat researcher, though, I know it shouldn't sound like this. It's kind of exciting. And the reason I say that is because it's new threat types, right? We're not looking at the same cross-site scripting, SQL injection, phishing. This is something new, right? I mean, all the old threats are still threats, but a new threat to assess and try to learn to mitigate and deal with. It's kind of exciting. It's new toys in the toy box. So I'm not worried about it. And like I said, I think Claude will be okay.
Nick, what you're saying there reminds me of a quote actually from Straker's Jun Zhao, who wrote a kind of report on this. And he said, quote, "The attack surface exposed by the Claude code leak is not a Claude-specific problem. It's a window into the systemic vulnerabilities of agentic AI at large. The same compaction pipelines, permission chains, and MCP interfaces exist across every enterprise agent deployment." And here's the big part for me. What changed on March 31st is that the attack research cost collapsed, right? Like you said, it basically gave them this insight into how these things work very, very easily. JR, I wanted to ask for your thoughts there. Do you think that's the accurate kind of take here, that like, look, what this really did was it just gave attackers a much easier way to get in and understand these things? What do you think?
When one has access to the NPM, the JavaScript maps that take you back to the source code, you have visibility. And if the source code artifacts are still there, you have visibility into how some things are getting done. And in fact, for Claude Code, I believe there are some future releases that are going to come out, I think, which is Think Offline. And there's another one about a dream mode. And there's these other modes that they are thinking about. So this gives attackers who are actually looking for additional intelligence an insight. Potentially, it would give them some insight into the kinds of features that are forthcoming and the kinds of attacks they might actually try to fashion. Yes, so we can see that in the short term that might help them. But in the longer term, exactly as Nick said, I think Claude Code will be just fine. We'll move along, and then we have to see how we deal with more of the AI supply chain security issues.
Absolutely, right? Because it's like Nick said, you know, we can't have nice things. This stuff was going to get, somebody was going to get into it at some point. So this was really an inevitability in a lot of ways. And we'll see more of this kind of thing play out. It's a matter of how we respond, right? And JR, you already kind of motioned towards tightening that supply chain security, really looking at your NPM packages, really paying attention to that. But I also wanted to pose to kind of Nick and Dave what your thoughts are in terms of, okay, what's the so what here, right? We now live in a landscape where cyber criminals have access to this in a way they didn't have it before. What does that mean for us as defenders? What do we change, if anything? Dave, I'll throw to you first. What's your takeaway there?
Proactive mode being enabled in this source code is a big deal. So it allows the engine to code for you 24/7. You don't have to sit there and do your own manual coding. That's probably the biggest impact that I can see right now as far as malicious actors and nefarious activity. They're going to have code written for them while they sleep. They don't have to do anything.
I don't have a silver bullet. My real thought on this is we're just going to have to do more testing in lab environments before upgrading and progressing to next versions and using software in our environments. That's about the only thing I can really think of, because every time we come up with mitigation methods, that one gets thrown out the window. Check the hash. Well, no, not this time. You know, patch your stuff. Well, not so fast. Got to slow down, because if you patch too fast, you're downloading something that you didn't test and now you're compromised. So a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And what was it? N-1 that our colleagues said.
N-1.
Always make sure you're one safe version behind.
I did see that idea come up, right? The idea that the latest version of these packages on when you're working with like open source libraries is usually not the most secure one. It's like the one step or two steps behind, right? Like you have to, like you said, Nick, there's you got to kind of test these things first. And so maybe that's one of the things we have to keep in mind going forward. But I have to move us along here to our second story for today. And this is yet another story of kind of supply chain attacks having wide-reaching ramifications. I'm talking about Team PCP's ongoing breach spree. Again, I'm sure this is a story you folks are familiar with because Team PCP has been in the news for quite some time now, starting with a breach of the Trivi security scanner, which led to Light LLM being compromised, Telnix, a handful of other open source projects. And now the gang is using the credentials they've harvested from those info stealers to break into cloud and SaaS instances, including a European Commission cloud that was hacked and exposed the data of at least 29 other union entities. So pretty big deal here. Researchers at Wiz Security, cloud security firm Wiz, wrote a report analyzing this, and their kind of main takeaway was that the escalating attacks show that Team PCP prioritizes speed rather than subtlety and stealth. In other words, they don't really seem to care about being caught. They're just moving as quickly as they possibly can and getting the data they can and ripping through things. Dave, what do you think about that kind of take here? Does that sound accurate to you? Does it seem like Team PCP is just kind of moving fast and breaking things in a sense? What are you seeing out there?
I came up with a word while you were talking. They're brazen. They are absolutely brazen in their attacks. All they do is just attack things. They really don't have a rhyme or reason to whom they're attacking, but they're really quick to do it. I mean, if they can get a credential, it seems like they're going to use it. And it only takes one credential, just ask the European Commission. One single credential is all it took to break in there. And that was impressive to me.
That's scary when you said that, Dave, to go from, it's not credentials, it was a credential, single.
One. Yep.
Yeah. You said that the first time and I needed you to repeat it.
and I mean, that could be like the summary of this whole Team PCP breach spree, right? Because if you think back to it, the initial way they started getting all this access was they broke into the Trivi security scanner, right? And that too was they stole what did they steal? I have it in my notes here. A single privileged access token from the GitHub Actions environment that the Trivi team was maintaining. And this is the part that really is like the kicker for me, is that the Trivi team was aware of this and they rotated all their credentials, except they just missed one. They missed one instance of that credential. It was still there. They didn't realize it. And the attackers were able to get in. And it shows, Dave, like you said, all it takes is one credential. And JR, I wanted to, you know, looking at that kind of elaborate process that we're talking about here of a supply chain attack having all of these snaking ramifications, what do you think that really says to us about, like, the difficulty of protecting our systems and our credentials in these really complex environments we've built? What do you see in there?
So I think I probably already said this in a previous version of the podcast. I think identity is the new perimeter, the last perimeter, the most important perimeter that one has to deal with. And that's what Team PCP is trying to do here, right? I mean, they're trying to go after that and they want to get access to credentials, as many credentials. Now, one may think, one may try to put in countermeasures like on the one hand, you can try to practice security hygiene in terms of making sure that you don't leave any credentials in the code that you ship. On the other hand, you can come from the other side and say, okay, maybe my credentials can also be short-lived. I can try to cycle them faster, right? And so on. And so, and maybe they are they're recognizing that these countermeasures of short-lived credentials are going to come up. And so they're trying to run through source code as fast as possible to get their hands on as many credentials as they can.
That's a very good point, right? They might be, the part of the reason they're moving so fast might be because they're anticipating this kind of response to them, right? But Nick, I want to ask you, you know, again, I just keep coming back to the fact that, like, they tried to rotate credentials, they missed one thing, and that's what left them open. What makes, like, credential protection so difficult for us right now? Like JR just pointed out, we can do things like just-in-time credentials and whatnot, but we don't really seem to do it that often. What's going on? What do you think it is, Nick? What's keeping us from it?
So I think we overcomplicate things. And in this case, I think that's exactly what happened. Is we overcomplicated it. There were, and I could say that, and then the opposite could be true. But in this case, they had too many credentials to rotate. They didn't have, a good enough procedure in place to make sure they quality checked everything they did so that they wouldn't miss one. But sometimes, and I know no one wants to hear this, sometimes the bad guy's just gonna win. Right? Because they're just going to be faster. They don't have the same practices we do. They don't have to follow procedures. They don't have to go through QA. They can just, as we said, Dave said, they were brazen, right? They got their hands on got their hands on the keys. Like, let's hurry up and try these keys before people change the locks. It's just how it works. And sometimes you win some and sometimes you lose some. In this case right now, I hate being in reactive mode, but the best thing you can do is be in reactive mode for this one, because we now know what are some of the ways to detect what showed that you might have been compromised. If you are even a part of this, I would just assume full compromise and take the steps needed to check everything from soup to nuts.
Absolutely. I mean, again, looking at the fact that it all it took was one missed non-rotated credential, like you can't be too cautious in this one, you know? And you also, you know, gestured towards something that's come up a lot on the show recently is this idea that, like, one of the things that can kind of make it difficult for us as defenders to keep up is that we have, like, guardrails and responsibilities and ethics we have to follow, you know, and they don't. And, like, hearkening back to what we were just talking about with Claude Code and its source code leak, it's like, when we implement something like Claude Code, we have to make sure we're doing it securely, we're doing it ethically. They don't have those concerns. They can just use it however they want, you know, and that does put us at something of a, I don't want to say disadvantage because you know, but it makes the playing field not totally even sometimes. But Dave, I want to loop around to another part of this story, which is that there have been some reports of some murky attribution because our old friends Shiny Hunters and Lapsus are popping up again, and they're taking credit for some of Team PCP's work, or at the very least, they're touting that they have data from organizations that Team PCP is said to have breached. And it doesn't seem like they're actually working together. It seems like there's some kind of competition here. I don't know. Have you seen this at all? Do you have any thoughts on what's going on there?
That's actually the first that I heard that Shiny Happy Hunters has has taken credit for that. I'm not surprised that they're having a little competition. It's probably not a friendly competition between bad actor groups. You don't want someone taking credit for your work. And this sounds like praise. It's really not. Taking credit for someone else's work just isn't the right way to go about things. But we are talking about threat actor groups here. Is this really a surprise? I don't think so.
The other thing to remember is you definitely have threat actor group participant overlap, right? So they all use affiliates. Sometimes they use the same people for certain things. And you may have somebody or some buddies who are members of Team PCP who are also participants in, you know, Shiny Happy Hunters, as we like to call them, because there's multiple groups. Same people can be parts of same groups, of different groups, I mean.
No, that's a very good point, right? We have to be careful not to take this stuff at face value. And this is a thing that's also going to come out in our final segment for today. But, like, just because attackers are saying a certain thing doesn't mean we necessarily have to believe them. Like, it turns out a lot of what cybercriminals say is lying. And so, like, you know, I do think about, though, like, I don't know, you know, that lying does make things a little murkier for us, right? JR, what do you think, like, when it comes to this murky attribution, does that make our lives difficult, or do you feel like it's just kind of a distraction from securing stuff? What's your take there?
It really doesn't matter in many ways. It may matter to law enforcement in terms of taking down some of these threat actors and some of these groups, but from a defender perspective, I mean, does it really matter whether it is Team PCP or Lapsus or Shiny Happy Hunters, I mean, you're still a victim of a cyber attack.
No, absolutely, right? Like, at the end of the day, attribution is less important than, like, are you taking the steps you need to recover to secure yourselves, right? And I mean, Nick, you already said, you know, basically you can't be too careful here. You know, you got to assume breach and reset everything. But, you know, Dave, any last thoughts in terms of like, all right, I'm an organization. I'm living in the post-Team PCP world. What do I do? How do I strengthen my defenses? Any last thoughts there before we round out the segment?
I wanted to say that attribution kind of does matter to us, though, because it does give us our TTPs to look for in the environments that we're protecting. So while it does matter more to law enforcement, we still get a good sense of what we're dealing with when we get those attributions. So be it murky as they may be, it's still good to know who's in your environment.
No, that makes sense. I guess it's a balance, right? Like, it's important to have those attributions, but you also don't want to get caught up in, you know, in that murk and being like, oh, was it Team PCP? Was it? Because, you know, you at the end of the day, you just want to make sure you have the information you need to respond, you know, practically and proactively and constructively.
So you can always trust the dishonest person to be dishonest.
We can end the segment on that nice little zen moment. Let's move on to our next story for today, folks. We're talking about near-miss databases. Now, most threat intelligence focuses on events that did happen, but researchers from 1Password and hacklore.org argue that sharing info on the attacks we've averted might be even more useful. Now, this comes out of a presentation at RSA 2026 a couple weeks ago by Wendy Nather and Bob Lord, who made the case for developing what they call near-miss reporting channels, where individuals in organizations and between organizations, maybe, can share things like what almost happened, what stopped it, which controls mattered, and what assumptions were proved wrong. The general idea is that analyzing our successes can yield as much valuable information as analyzing our failures. Nick, I want to get your initial reactions here to this idea of like a near-miss database. Do you think this is something useful to be pursuing? What's your take?
Well, at the risk of being rude, I almost want to say, duh. of course we should study what has been successful. It would be ignorant not to. So I'd be wrapping a name around it or an idea or a theology around it, whatever you want to call it. It's a great idea. But I think we've already been doing that. I mean, how often do we study what occurs in maybe a honeypot environment? Or do we study what maybe our devices have been blocking and we still go and see, hey, what was that? What was trying to break in? How did it work? So from a threat researcher standpoint, it's a great idea. So as much as I started off the way I did, no, that's great. I think we should do it. And if we're not doing it, that is a huge miss on our part.
Absolutely. And one of the things that that the researchers say they believe stops some organizations from doing this is a kind of culture of blame, right? They say that people are hesitant to share their near misses because they worry about being implicated, right? Like, if you're the guy who clicked the phishing email, are you going to self-report and say, I clicked the phishing email, but everything's okay now? And Dave, I wanted to ask you, do you feel like that's an obstacle that we're dealing with, or is that kind of overblown? What's your take on this blame situation?
Getting a black eye is pretty big for anyone, whether it be an individual or a company. And no one wants to say, hey, we were attacked. It would be nice if it was completely anonymized. I think it would work better. I think people would be more apt to share there. But as long as it's, you know, company names or individuals' names being broadcast in this near-miss database, it's not going to be successful. I don't think anybody wants to take part in that kind of thing.
No, absolutely. And anonymization sounds like a really simple way to kind of address the problem, right? Like, look, if people are worried about raising their hand, make sure that nobody knows it's them who raised their hand. I like that. It's simple. It gets right to the point. And one of the researchers' kind of stated goals on that front is to kind of shift the paradigm around blame, right? To instead of always saying, let me quote the researcher, Wendy Nather, because I like this quote a lot. I don't want to put words in her mouth. She says, quote, I hate the saying humans are the weakest link. How about we build systems so that humans don't have to be responsible? JR, I wanted to get your thoughts on this idea of, like, is it possible to build systems where humans are not the weakest link? Can we do that, or will humans kind of always be in that unfortunate position? What do you think?
No, it's definitely possible to build systems in which humans are not the weakest link. But I did want to go back a little bit to the earlier discussion about the near misses before we come to that particular question, because there are a couple of very important threads here, right? For a while now, we've been talking about having the analog of a National Transportation Safety Board, an NTSB, for cyber. And think of this as a cybersecurity safety review board. And one of our famous researchers, Steve Belovin, who's at Columbia University, was actually chaperoning and spearheading this idea that the intelligence is really in the near misses. I mean, we know the crashes which happen, but only studying crashes after they happen is more like calling NTSB after the crash happens. But what you really want to use that parallel to be able to study near misses so that you can cultivate the best practices and try to protect and harden systems in a more more proactive fashion. So there's a very nice analogy there, and that's something that we should not lose sight of, right? Okay. So now your question about what to do with the human in the loop, right? I think this is probably a little bit more related to agentic systems, perhaps, and probably takes us in a slightly different direction. I think because of the autonomy that agentic systems have and because of their reliance on mechanisms like LLMs that hallucinate, we do have a certain amount of unpredictability and risk associated with how agents are working. And so having a human in the loop, human on the loop, is important, especially for many mission-critical tasks. And in fact, maybe I'm looking forward even to the next segment that you're going to talk about, where many of the attackers, for example, are using techniques like AI to be able to very quickly do the low-risk, low-hanging tasks, but that when they really want to move in for the kill, they are trying to be, they always will have a human in the loop.
No, that's a very good point, actually. I hadn't even thought about that parallel, and we should dig into that more when we get to that next story. But you're right, even the cyber criminals, at least according to their self-reports, are keeping that human in the loop, right? Nick, I wanted to ask you, too, about this idea of, like, you know, humans being the weakest link and whether we can build systems where that doesn't have to be the case anymore, right? Like, do you think that's possible, or do you think it's shifting things? I don't know. What's your take there? What do you think?
No.
I love the simplicity.
and I say that not because I don't think we can do better, because I do think we can get close to it. I just don't think we'll ever get there completely, because people are flawed, and we will always look for a faster, easier, way to do something. And if that means that we can circumvent security in some way, shape, or form to make our job faster and easier, someone will do it. And so it's human nature that's going to make it not, I don't want to say impossible, but I will say improbable.
No, I get that. And I think that I agree with you on that. And I think that by gesturing towards like agentic AI, like JR just did, it points out that like maybe what we have to do, it's not where you can kind of make humans no longer the weak link or make technology no longer the weak link, but it's about compensating for each other. You know what I mean? And I think especially with agentic AI, that's what we're talking about when we have a human in the loop, right? It's like, look, the agent's going to be great at some things, but not others. And so you stick a human in there. And a human's going to be great at some things, but not others. And so you put the agent in there. And maybe that's my kind of like utopian view of how these things can play out. But I'm a little optimistic about that. To round out this segment, Dave, I just want to open it up to you. Any final thoughts on this situation? Any last words for us before we move on to our final segment for the week?
I think it can work if it's anonymized. I mean, that's really the biggest issue that I see is just self-reporting. It's just not something a lot of companies want to do unless they're forced.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. And I like that as a way to end that segment. So let's move on, folks, to our last story for this week. Can cyber criminals teach us about AI adoption? Now, over on LinkedIn, Ciaran Martin, who is the founder of the UK's National Cybersecurity Center, observed that, quote, some of the most mature attitudes to adopting AI in business processes seem to be coming from cyber criminals. This was in response to a post from author Jeff White, who had recounted some conversations he had with ransomware operators around AI adoption. The operators, by and large, said their use of it was limited to the, quote, simplification of everyday tasks, and they left the real hacking to human professionals, as they called them. Dave and Nick, I know you were both extremely skeptical of this story in a lot of ways, so I want to open up. Let's throw to you first, Nick. You look at this, Jeff White's reporting. What do you think's going on here?
I feel like it's a little bit of a red herring. Or just someone trolling, maybe rage bait. I don't know, but the idea is not, it's going to sound crazy, it's not bad. Because you would think, you know, why would I ask a criminal about their plan? And then I think, well, has anyone ever seen how villains like to monologue, right? It's an appeal to their pride. You might not get answers from all of them, but somebody might. Somebody might decide that they want to tell you about their dastardly plan because they're just so proud of what they came up with. And they share those plans with you and take it or leave it. But I think it's actually possible.
I think it's hard to get 12 people to say the same thing, no matter what it is. If you handed them a piece of paper that was solid white and you said, what color is this paper? 3 of them would say it's yellow. But he managed to get a dozen or so ransomware operators to say the same thing. They're not employing AI as much as you would think. They are using the human in the loop to get most of the work done. They use the simplified tasks. They're handed off to AI, but those more difficult tasks to accomplish, they're handling themselves. So I think it's, you know, the fact that they've got 12 people, 12 criminals to say the same thing, you know, maybe there's some credence there.
I was going to say, I think we have to remember that just because someone is a cyber criminal doesn't also mean they may not have a day job. They may still be just your regular white-collar professional doing something else. And I guess, you know, maybe they don't have a way of compartmentalizing, right?
I always say the best cyber, you know, a cyber analyst would make the best cyber criminal. They know what to look for and what to avoid. So maybe they're cyber analysts. We don't know.
We have seen that pretty recently, right? What was it? It was the Black Cat ransomware that turned out to be operated by some folks who were, you know, their day jobs were security at some point. So, you know, we do see that. But JR, you had in the last segment started to talk about already some of the things maybe we can learn from cyber criminals, right? And mentioning this idea of like leaving the low-level stuff to the agents, high-level stuff to the humans. Did you want to expand on that? You know, what do you think is going on here?
So I think we have to unpack a little bit when you talk about cyber attackers using AI. I don't think they're really using AI as much as exploiting the conditions that AI is creating. And this goes back to the very first segment that we talked about, which is that AI is absolutely expanding the attack surface. We all know this, right? I mean, there are new artifacts, ranging from models and data to applications and infrastructure. And, this is a new attack surface. And what the attackers are really doing is exploiting the weaknesses in this new attack surface. So basically, you know, what AI does, it just doesn't give these attackers new tools. It gives them a new attack surface vocabulary. They can now start talking of models, data, infrastructure, application, where some of these were not part of their vocabulary before. Of course, what AI does do is it changes also the economics, right? I mean, it changes the scale, scope, and frequency of the attacks that they can do. And that's the part which automates some of the less risky, low-hanging fruit. The last thing attackers really want to do is to use AI for that last mile. For heaven forbid, if that AI hallucinates, then game over, right? And so that's something that one has to keep in mind as one goes forward.
Yeah, JR, you're spot on about that one, because I don't remember off the top of my head which one it was. It was either Trivi or Axios, but one of them only got detected because one of them threw errors. And so if it hadn't thrown the errors, it never would have got caught. So I could definitely see where you're going with the, you know, make sure that that last mile is taken up by a person and not the AI giving it a chance to bumble things on you.
No, I think that's an extremely good point, right? And it gets back to, again, that idea of like the human in the loop at crucial times. And you don't often think about like when I'm extorting people as a cyber criminal to be a crucial time, but like it is for them, right? In their cycle.
It's only business, Matt. It's only business.
You know, in a sense it is. But now, getting back to the original LinkedIn post that spawned me this topic, Jeff White, his kind of takeaway from his conversations with cyber criminals was that now is the time for defenders to double down on AI because they can basically get a leg up. If the cyber criminals are still using it for low-level stuff, he reasons, what if we start using it for higher-level stuff faster than they can? Dave, I want to ask you, do you think that's the kind of right approach here? Like, is that what our opportunity is, or what are you taking away from it?
I think that's actually a pretty good approach, is for us to get on the offensive instead of the defensive, like we said earlier in the call. We're being reactive much more than we're being proactive, and being proactive in this case, I don't really see the downside to that.
Absolutely. And so on that note, what do we think that getting proactive might look like? And JR, I'll throw it to you first there. What do you think, you know, getting proactive with our use of AI as cybersecurity professionals, what do you think that could possibly look like? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm very optimistic and I'm looking forward, because in decades, we now have an opportunity to let me not say level the playing field, but at least up our game in the whole cyber defender space. Because by using AI first, I call that AI first, or AI before human. That's another term that we use at IBM. AI first or AI before human. We now have a chance to respond at the rate and pace of AI, right? Which is very fast. And I think that was a very, very powerful capability that we did not have, and that can really reduce the cognitive burden that many of our SOC analysts are facing, and in fact, really disrupt that whole profession, so that they can really focus on tasks and investigations that really require their talents and expertise, and leave the more mundane jobs to AI. That's what I think this looks like.
I agree completely. And I think this is a chance that we have to get a leg up, because one of the things, and this may just be me being, you know, naive or ignorant, but one of the things that we have is the horsepower and the backing and the power to do more with AI than your typical bad actor, right? Because the one thing that makes AI more and more powerful is the horsepower and the power that it takes to run it, right? So between the resources that we have available, and I want to say quantum computing that we have coming really quick up on its heels to be what we run it with, sky's the limit.
I think it's a good point. This might be one of those rare places where it feels like the asymmetry is actually on our side, right? Like we talked earlier about how there was an asymmetry that benefits the attackers because they don't have to follow guardrails. Like you said, Nick, your average organization, your average SOC has access to way more resources, way more horsepower, as you put it. Dave, how about you? Any thoughts on your end in terms of what proactive use of AI by cybersecurity professionals actually looks like, or what you'd like to see them do with it?
I'd like to see them run some scripts that catch this stuff before it happens, or gives us a little bit of a view into the mindset of what the attackers are doing with AI. Put their code in that we've seen and have our AI spit out what we need to do to counter that. I think that'd be a good place to start.
Absolutely. To close out the show, folks, I just want to ask you a question that a commenter left on Jeff White's original post that started this whole thing. This is a question from Kevin Haynes, CEO of Reveal Security, and I like it, so I'm just going to pose it as a roundtable question to each of you. He wrote, "Who do you think is the bigger threat, the ransomware operator or the vibe coding marketing person who's stitching together shadow apps and integrations?" And Nick, I'll start with you. Who do you think is the bigger threat, the ransomware operator or the person vibe coding in the marketing department who doesn't know what they're doing with the AI? What do you think's going on?
I'm going to go with B there, Matt, because that's going to go right back to our, you know, human in the loop is the weakest link conversation, because who knows what kind of shadow IT that person's throwing up that's going to just put huge holes in your security posture.
Absolutely. I mean, it really does give credence to your point about maybe it's not totally possible to make the human not the weakest link, you know? JR, how about you? Who's the bigger threat, the ransomware operator or the vibe coding employee?
I'm going to take the third option, which is, I think it's both. Because one is creating an attack surface and the other is exploiting it. I mean, this is the basis of, and so neither of them is really contributing to improving the security of your enterprise. And that's the reason why I think, you know, both are to blame. And in fact, if you really want it, if you really pushed me, I would say the vibe coder, because he should know better. You're assuming he's taken his security engineering courses and his business conduct guidelines courses, as opposed to the ransomware attacker who's sentenced or, you know, because of his DNA to be a ransomware attacker, right? So.
Dave, I'm sorry, you have to follow up JR's judo maneuver on the question, but what would your answer be?
No, I don't. I can take option four and say, I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know which
well
one's
played.
Worse. Honestly, I don't know which one's worse. They're both terrible. And the only thing that I'll say is that, you know, going off the perception that we have that hackers just have all the time in the world, maybe they are the worst. Whereas, you know, the marketing guy still got to do marketing for his job.
This is true. He's got some deliverables.
Yeah.
Folks, that does it for this episode today. I want to thank you, our panelists, Nick and Dave and JR. Thank you to the viewers and the listeners. Thank you to our producers who don't get enough credit, if you ask me. So thank you, producers. Subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there. And the next time you almost get caught in a cyber attack, I don't know, maybe tell us about it. The YouTube comments are open. We could talk about it.